Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In 1918, the leaders of the FBI, William Burns and J. Edgar Hoover, expressed deep concern about the power of movie stars to affect politics. And so they began a surveillance program to watch over those whom they thought might be radicals. Their surveillance revealed some stars who had become part of the so-called Red Movement. Since then, it has long seemed that the Hollywood crowd was ideologically left. But our next guest says that's actually not true. Stephen Ross joins us in studio for a two-part discussion about his book, Hollywood Left and Right, which is just out in paperback. He's a historian at the University of Southern California and author of numerous books, including this one, Hollywood Left and Right. Welcome, Stephen Ross. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I think I want to start with one of your premises, and here's a quote right out of your book. Movie stars do more than just show us how to dress, look, or love. They teach us how to think and act politically. How so?
Well, I think one of the great things that movie stars do and have done since the 19-teens, is they draw attention to issues. And people who are anti-Hollywood, and it's not even conservatives, because you have a lot of conservative stars who have been political. But people who are anti-Hollywood just simply dismiss it and see it as star worship and what can they tell us, et cetera, et cetera. They miss the big point. The big point is, right from the start, when movie stars started going out on the road, starting in World War I, selling war bonds, or when they started going out on the road with candidates, what would happen, the biggest influence movie stars have had is actually they get us to think. It's not what they have to say. That our lives are busy. We often don't pay attention to things. We think things are, it's the same old, whether it was 1917 or today. But suddenly when somebody you get that you admire gets involved in either a cause or a candidate, it draws your attention. And once it draws your attention, you're the one who decides, am I going to actually read something about this? Am I going to listen to this person? Am I going to find more about this cause? And what has done it is, again, it's the celebrity who has brought you to it. But these polls, I get very upset when I read these polls about, well, is so-and-so, is Oprah's endorsement, let's go back to 2008, first time she endorses a candidate, is Oprah's endorsement more likely to make you vote for Obama? It's the wrong question. It's kind of like saying, when did you stop beating your husband or wife? Either way, you sound like an idiot. The real question should be, would Oprah's endorsement or any star get you to pay more attention to a candidate or an issue?
So it's the agenda setting function.
That's right, because otherwise if you say, yes, it's going to get me more likely to vote, you sound like a moron, that you have no real brain. And in fact, what it is it simply gets you to pause for a moment and say, okay, let me actually think about this.
Do you think it's really because when somebody has achieved celebrity status that all of the news media then call attention to the issue? Or is it the celebrity status itself?
It's both. First of all, we've now gone on 24/7 news. If you notice, you go through history, all Jack Kennedy's affairs, none of them got reported at the time, A, because there was a kind of code, an ethos. But I will tell you, if Kennedy had lived through 24/7 media, that ethos would have gone out of the door because they simply needed copy. So it's gotten, in other words, there's always been a kind of celebrity worship in the media. It's always good for business. Let's remember, it's a business. The celebrity business is a business. It's not just about your fantasies. It's selling them. And so, if you want to get, whether it's ratings on TV or ratings, getting people to buy your newspapers, you want the kind of gossipy stuff that's going to draw attention. And celebrities draw attention.
That also brings up the kind of relationship people have with celebrities. You say it's a love-hate relationship.
Right. You can, for example, really like a movie star. And let's say you're an action kind of movie person. And you've always loved Mel Gibson. And then you find out who he really is. And suddenly, I can't tell you how many people I know said, including myself, I'll never go see a Mel Gibson movie again.
People thought he was the character before.
Yes, and they thought he was a certain kind of person. And what happens, and this is something William DeMille, who is the left-wing brother of Cecil DeMille, the most conservative director, talked about even in the 1930s, that We love our movie stars until they actually speak out on something controversial, and then they turn out to have feet of clay. So if you're a Democrat and you hear a Republican speaking out, or a movie star that you didn't know their politics, suddenly speaking out in a very conservative fashion, it would likely turn you off. Likewise, if you're conservative and you hear some star that you didn't know what their politics were speaking out on a left-wing agenda, you get turned off. And, you know, we can go back to Sid Grauman, who had Grauman's Chinese, who was one of the more innovative exhibitors of his time. He would warn movie stars in the 19-teens, never speak out politically, and I can sort of quote him here, never speak out politically because the moment you do, it's bad for the old box office-aroo. And you can bring that all the way up to Michael Jordan at his peak was quite, you know, was often questioned by, you know, reporters from Nation and places like this, sort of more left progressive, saying, how come you don't use your star personality to speak out on issues of importance, particularly race issues? And his response is, Republicans buy Nikes. And my response to him is, Mr. Jordan, how wealthy do you have to be? But you know what? There are people who don't want their image soiled, and it's true. The moment you open your mouth as a movie star, you are going to alienate half of your potential audience.
And you aptly point out in your book that throughout Hollywood, that this has really guided so many actors to avoid politics, and yet there were those that went forward. You picked 10 of them.
That's correct.
And 10 of them for several reasons, including their impact. 5 on the right, 5 on the left. Let's start with any common thread that you saw among them.
Well, the most interesting thing is many of them came from what you could call broken homes. And I still haven't, I'm a historian rather than a psychologist, although I often play a psychologist in everyday life. But I don't really know. It would be hard. But so many of them had Charlie Chaplin, drunken father, Louis B. Mayer, I'm going in order now, a father that would kind of beat him and accuse him of working too hard rather than going and studying the Talmud. Edward G. Robinson, a father that didn't hurt him in any way, but he never talked about his girlfriends. And he didn't even have a girlfriend until he was like 30, and he was afraid to bring her home because she was a shiksa, you know, non-Jew. And you can go to Reagan, and these are the people I'm talking about in order of my book. Reagan and Murphy both had, Murphy's father died early. Reagan's father was an alcoholic. You move ahead to Jane Fonda, Henry Fonda, one of the worst fathers in Hollywood. Charlton Heston coming from a broken home. Harry Belafonte, a father who left the family very early on. Warren Beatty, a father who had trouble with alcohol. Arnold Schwarzenegger, a father who was rough on the kids. Everyone seemed to have difficult fathers. Now, how you figure that, you ask me what's the common thread? That's one of them. The other thing, if there's a common thread in the more admirable, it's that all 10 were willing to take a risk. And that is something rare. All 10 of them understood that speaking out politically could hurt them in the box office. Even Louis B. Mayer, it could hurt his studio. But all 10 of them felt it was incumbent upon them as a citizen. And to that extent, that's why I say I really admire all 10 politically. I may not like their politics, and in the case of Louis B. Mayer, I may not like him personally, but I admire somebody who is willing to do that risk, who's willing to put their money where their mouth is.
Now, Louis B. Mayer, first of all, I'm going to ask you to remind listeners who he is. It seemed that he was the one that used politics to help his business more than the others.
Yes. Well, Louis B. Mayer was the head of MGM Studios, really the first head. And what people don't know, one of the things I bring in the book is I deal with two what I call myths of Hollywood. And that led me to have these counterintuitive theses that, again, I like to write books about things I don't know, so I get surprised. And the sort of common wisdom about Hollywood is it's filled with lefties and liberals, and that it's always been this way. It's always been the bastion of the left. And one of the things I found was first that conservatives have a longer history in Hollywood than liberals do. And second, that even though the Hollywood left has been more numerous and visible, the Hollywood right has actually had a greater impact on American political life and on the nature of the American state. And it really starts with Louis B. Mayer, because he is really the first key political figure in Hollywood. You have Charlie Chaplin before then, who's making what I call anti-authoritarian films. But Chaplin is sort of on his own. Mayer is the first person to create a relationship between a studio and a political party. He is the man who brings the Republican Party into Hollywood, and he brings Hollywood into the Republican Party. And he turns MGM into a publicity wing of the GOP. And he goes on, he's serious enough that he goes on to become the head of the California GOP. He's a power broker at the 1928 presidential primaries. He strikes a deal, a secret deal between Herbert Hoover and William Randolph Hearst, that gives Hoover enough delegates to get the nomination on the first ballot. And Mayer, a number of his films also take a very, as opposed to the Warner Brothers, which kind of take a left liberal point of view of American life, Mayer's studio really puts forth a conservative ideology. And as I write about in the book, nothing more on the nose for today's conservative politics than the one series he put his heart into, which was the Hardy Family series, the most successful series in MGM history. And if you watch these movies, starring Mickey Rooney, and some of them have Judy Garland, but some of them not, what you see is it's Ronald Reagan's, it is the basis of Reagan's Morning in America. It's God, family, and country are all we need. And you never need to rely on the government. You need to rely on God, family, patriotism, and your sort of home community. And that will solve all the problems. It's not government. It's the sort of local people pulling together. And he does it in a very appealing fashion. And it does it in a fashion that you want to believe it, because then everything's going to be fine.
The other interesting thing about him was what he did to sort of catapult the Republican Party in terms of bringing in tactics, like you mentioned, the dirty politics. How did he do that?
Well, what I was surprised by, it's been the Republicans and the conservatives, not the liberals and Democrats, who have actually pioneered the uses of mass media for political ends. two things Mayer did early on, well, three things he did early on that were really interesting. The first is, as I mentioned, he turned MGM into a publicity wing of the Republican Party. And what do I mean by that? Anytime a famous Republican figure would come through L.A., whether it was a congressperson, a senator, a governor, president, Mayer would find out who their favorite actor, actresses were. Whether they were at MGM or not, he would bring them onto the studio lot. He would build a special set for a lunch. He would put the candidate on his dais and then put the two movie stars on either side of him. He would then make sure he had his studio photographers come in. Excuse me. And the next day, a picture of that politician and these famous movie stars would go out on every wire service throughout the country, giving that politician a patina of glamour that any potential opponent would lack. So, you know, you get a politician with Mary Pickford or Douglas Fairbanks or one of his people there. And, you know, he understood the power of glamour and publicity and using it for politics. Mayer was also put in charge of the 1928 Republican convention to make it lively. And the 24 convention was broadcast on some radios, and it was considered an island of dullness. And even though we can't imagine, well, how can you make radio exciting? He tried to create a program at the committee filled with bands, filled with balloons coming down, filled with a sense of excitement, so that when listeners heard it on the radio, what they heard were bands, they heard fanfare, they heard that this was something really exciting and that they could imagine it, that he turned politics into the excitement of the imagination. And it would be his protege, George Murphy, who would instruct Republicans. He was really the first one. He tried in 48 with Dewey, who wouldn't listen to him, Thomas Dewey, who ran against Truman. And that was the famous election where Dewey got too arrogant, thinking he was so far ahead he couldn't lose. And he did. And Murphy was trying to say, no, you come across on TV terribly. And when Ike ran in 52, Murphy and Robert Montgomery became Ike's TV consultants. But the other thing he did was Dirty Tricks that in many ways preceded the Kerry Bush campaign, where in 1934, Upton Sinclair, a longtime socialist, switched over to the Democratic Party, figuring he's never going to win as a socialist, but maybe he could win as a Democrat, was running for governor, and it looked like he was on the path to win. And Mayer came back from a European vacation and came to a studio because he was alerted to the fact that this was going to be bad for business, that Sinclair City was going to raise taxes on the studios. And so he sent out a reporter to do these semi-fake newsreels. And what they did is they sent this the roving reporter around the state, and he would interview people. There were three candidates, Republican, Democrat, and a sort of third dark horse figure. And the main opposition was the Republican Merriam. And what he did is he would have staged actors. So, for example, he had the reporter interviewing a black Republican, a man who was in front of his home, clearly a homeowner, white shirt, because costuming matters, how you present somebody, a bow tie, totally clean. Who are you going to vote for? I'm going to vote for Merriam because he will give us jobs, and I've done well for myself through hard work and blah, blah, blah. And you see, he's got his home, or at least it appears that way. And then they go to talk to some black voters who might be voting for Sinclair, and they walk up to a car, and there's a bunch of African Americans in the car, and when they roll down the window, all the smoke comes out, and you know they've been smoking weed in the car. It's so clear. And who are you voting for? Oh, man, we're going to vote for Sinclair. And the same thing, they get immigrants. They have an immigrant. Who are you going to vote for? And the one immigrant who says he's going to vote for Merriam is well-dressed. He speaks with a slight accent. But then the guy who's going to be for Sinclair speaks like he's a Russian revolutionary. And, you know, it was Sinclair is going to support the same kind of program they had in Russia. And it was good for there, and it's going to be good for here. So it's all these faked interviews that make it seem like if you vote for Sinclair, you're going to bring the communist revolution to America. And as a result of that, as well as Hearst running a similar smear campaign where he's showing all these bums coming in, saying that they're coming in because Sinclair's promising work for all of us, until somebody points out in a rival newspaper that the photograph that Sinclair had of the bums coming in Hearst's newspaper was actually a still from Warner Brothers' Wild Boys of the Road. So they had to run a retraction that, in fact, it wasn't true. But this is something Mayer pioneered and the Republicans would use over the years. They understood, how do you use media, even in a dirty way, to sway popular opinion?
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with historian Stephen Ross about his book, Hollywood Left and Right, which is just out in paperback. One of the things that I noticed that seemed like a theme is that those actors and movie stars who were on the right and conservative side seemed to continue on with more or less a successful life, whereas those that were more on the left were sort of demonized at some point, you know, whether it was Jane Fonda or whether it was Charlie Chaplin, and they seemed to have a much more difficult time.
Yes. And part of that has to do with the question of war. If there's a lesson here, it's if you come out ahead of public opinion on a war, and particularly opposition to the war, you are going to be demonized. And Ellen Goodman had a line that I love. We give medals to movie stars on the right and FBI dossiers to movie stars on the left. So you think that the careers of Charlie Chaplin and Edward G. Robinson were ruined because they were what Hueck and the Red Scare would later call premature anti-fascists. One of the most ridiculous phrases I've ever heard in my life, that during the 1930s, they were urging us to support the Allied cause and to oppose fascism. And they were joining with groups, particularly Robinson, and very later on, after he made The Great Dictator, Chaplin joined in. And we have this myth of the good war. We have this idea that Americans recognized Hitler immediately and knew how evil he was. And it is a myth, because in November 1936, you had something like 95% of the American population against any involvement with what was happening in Europe. And even as late as July 1941, and now we're talking almost 2 years into the war, you had 79% of Americans who had seen Hitler, had seen Mussolini, had seen what they were doing. They still wanted nothing to do with the war. So in a way, people like Chaplin, people like Edward G. Robinson, and many of the blacklisted, the Hollywood 10, should have been applauded later on, saying, you know, you guys told us what was right and wrong, and you saw it early. But instead, their careers were over because they were seen as aligned with communists. And the same thing would happen to Jane Fonda during the Vietnam War. You can get, one could argue to this day, you know, people like Sean Penn, Susan Sarandon, Tim Robbins, you know, came under terrible fire for their opposition to Iraq. And the irony is, every one of these left stars who suffered because they talked about anti-war in one case or getting involved in fighting fascism, history shows every one of them was right, and yet every one of them gets punished.
One of your more conservative actors actually collaborated with the Nazi government in some ways, bringing over the newspaper
right.
editors.
Well, kowtow is the word I would use. Starting in 1934, Adolf Hitler told the Hollywood studios that any one of you who has an office in Germany needs to fire any of your Jewish employees. We will not tolerate it. And if you don't fire those employees, we will not allow your studio to exhibit any of its films, either in Germany or any area we control. And every single studio except for Warner Brothers went along with it. They fired the Jewish employees. Warner Brothers responded by shutting down their operation, shutting down their office in Germany and moving it to England. And part of the reason is the studios were making 30 to 40% of their profits from foreign distribution, and they didn't want to risk their profits. And the incident you're mentioning is in June 1939. There are 10 Nazi newspaper editors touring L.A., and Mayer welcomes them onto the MGM lot and gives them a tour of the studio. And I saw some correspondence in the Warner Brothers files of somebody writes to Harry Warner saying, can't you talk to this guy? He's crazy. How can he tour these Nazis? You're a Jew. And Warner writes back saying, you know, Louis B. Mayer is going to do whatever he wants. No one can tell him what to do.
Let's back up a little bit and precede Mayer and go to Charlie Chaplin. Would you say he was the pioneer in using his film to affect the Americans politically?
He was a pioneer, yes. He's what I call the first political movie star. And that is, his politics were very eclectic, but they were kind of definitely left. And what I call, he was an instinctual radical. That, you know, he dropped out of school in elementary school. He was an autodidact. He taught himself everything. He was quite a bright man, but not consistent. He considered himself a socialist. At the time, he was the wealthiest man in Hollywood. And at the same time, he was, because of his upbringing, he was always pathologically afraid of being plunged back into poverty. And people who knew him well talked about his pathological cheapness. That I interviewed somebody, Larry Bachman, who used to play tennis with him. Chaplin was a little older. Bachman was on the tennis team at USC in the 1920s. And he told me Charlie Chaplin could break his arm reaching away from a check.
It came from the poverty he came from, though, right? It's like people who grew up in poverty often can't lose it.
Well, he grew up in something worse than poverty, which is when he was really small, his family was actually fairly well-to-do. They had a multi-bedroom apartment with a maid. And then his father started drinking again. The parents split up. His mother got sick. And they eventually wound up going from poorer to poorer to poorer circumstances until she was sent finally to an insane asylum, and he and his brother were sent to a workhouse. And at that point, they were in total poverty. And so he was always afraid. And yet, when you watch his early films, they are what I call anti-authoritarian, that he begins, in a sense, getting his instinctual politics. He doesn't want to do it left-right on the nose, but instead, his early films are constantly attacking authority figures up and down the class ladder, from employers to landlords to judges. Anyone who gives the working class people and immigrants a hard time really comes in for attack. And it's only by the 1930s, as he's by the 1920s starts touring the world, and he realizes world leaders, major intellectual leaders, and H.G. Wells, people like this, they all want to talk to him. George Bernard Shaw, they want to talk to him about ideas. And it's not until the 1930s that he has enough self-confidence that his films become much more politically focused. So he'll make Modern Times in 1936, and then The Great Dictator in 1940. And then after the war, he really goes to town and makes Monsieur Verdú and a number of films that get him totally into trouble. Where his films are being boycotted, he's being protested, and that's when he leaves the country.
Today, we've got Warren Beatty, we've got Charlton Heston, the legacy of Ronald Reagan and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Do you see a development of how their politics have come, or do you see them more individually compartmentalized?
It's interesting. I would say stars on the left have been more individually compartmentalized, and ironically, the stars on the right have followed a trajectory of how to use media. And again, not just followed a trajectory, created a trajectory of how to use media to further their political goals. So I mentioned Louis B. Mayer is the first one who starts with radio and figures out radio. And also Mayer, by 28 and 32, is staging the Republican conventions, and he's turning them into entertainment venues. He says, you know, a convention is no different than a movie opening. So you got to stage, it has to be a big hullabaloo, it has to be a big gathering. People need to want to see it rather than ought to see it. Murphy pioneers the use of television. I mean, he's talking about camera angles, about makeup. To me, what was interesting, in 1948, he's telling Tom Dewey, audiences don't like you. They may vote for you, they don't like you, because you're a smarty pants. You always have a quick answer, and he tells them, next time you go on TV, flub a line. And in fact, go on with a mustard stain on your tie. Look human. And Dewey blows him off and then loses the election. And 2 years later, when he runs again for governor, uses everything.
Did he put a mustard stain?
That I'm not sure, but he changed his appearance. Arnold Schwarzenegger is the next big breakthrough. He's truly the first one not just to understand the nature of 24/7 media, but use it. Schwarzenegger, if you look at people like Murphy, who goes on to become senator. For some of your listeners may not go back that far, remember, but Murphy was senator of California, elected in 1964. Reagan is elected as governor in 1966, and as we know, president in 1980. But what we don't know, when Schwarzenegger ran in the recall, the newspapers got it wrong, because they kept talking about how he was similar to Murphy and Reagan, too. B-movie stars who simply went into the political arena without knowing much. They just, you know, used their celebrity. They were totally wrong. Murphy and Reagan had worked in the trenches, worked as part of the building the conservative movement. Murphy from the 30s on, and Reagan really gets involved in the 50s with conservative politics. He's shifting from a liberal Democrat to liberal anti-communist Democrat and finally a conservative Republican by the early 50s. But when they enter the political arena, they've had 2 decades of working with Republican groups around the country, but particularly in California. What's interesting about Schwarzenegger is the first Hollywood figure to run for office with no real political ties. The only thing he had done is really campaign for George H.W. Bush.
But he married a political family.
That's right. He married into the Kennedys. And it's something, you know, I found some of his early writings and interviews. And when he was 18, he said, here's what my life is going to be. I'm going to be famous. I'm going to be a celebrity. And then I'm going to be a famous movie star. And then I'm going to be really wealthy. And then I'm going to marry into a famous political family and go for office. And everything he has said as a young man, he did in his life.
He probably didn't predict the latter part, though, with the affairs and the...
Well, he didn't say that, but that's beyond that trajectory. but he did everything he said. And when he ran, what audiences probably don't realize is he got the recall was the greatest thing that could have happened to him. Because if he had to go through a Republican primary, I don't believe he would have gotten the nomination. Because Arnold is very much like the liberal Republicans of the late 1960s, very conservative on fiscal and defense issues, and liberal on personal social issues. But in a contest of 150 some odd people running in the recall, he has the big name and he's able to win. And the other thing he does is he runs on his celebrity and not on the issues. He decides early on that, in fact, he said later on, Ted Kennedy, his uncle, gave him the advice, delay talking about specifics, because once you talk about specifics, they're going to tear you apart. So when it's less than a week to go from the election, and the LA Times runs a full page where they have, I think, roughly about a dozen of the leading candidates, and they've got these little boxes of like six major issues, and in a phrase, what the candidate says about the issues, Arnold's columns were completely blank. And it was only a week to go that he started talking about some of the issues. He was running on his celebrity. He was running on his fame. He was running on lines like, I'm going to tell legislators who aren't doing their job that they are going to be hasta la vista, baby. And talking about them as being girly men. And really playing and doing a lot of stunts.
He got 45% of the vote, as yes. I remember. Would that have worked in a regular election needed more than a majority?
It would have worked in a regular election if he could have gotten through the Republican primaries. But I don't believe he would have beaten Tom McClintock that time in the Republican primaries because the Republican Party was too conservative. They would not have gone for Arnold.
But again, the fact that he got 45% of the vote, or some thereabouts, I may have the number slightly off, suggests that maybe he couldn't have gotten a majority, at least the first time out, on those particular celebrities.
Well, I think you're wrong. When he's running against somebody as lackluster as Cruz Bustamante or even Tom McClintock, those were his two big opponents. Remember, we had two votes. One, are we going to recall Gray right. Davis? And if Davis is recalled, who do you vote for governor? And you had Cruz Bustamante, Tom McClintock, the outside Arianna Huffington, and Arnold.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, you point out, tended to always have a particular political ideology that was conservative fiscally. His predecessors, yeah. like Ronald Reagan, they sort of moved from ideology to ideology, didn't they? Especially Reagan.
Well, they didn't move from ideology to ideology. They moved from left to right. That's the other interesting thing I saw is George Murphy started as a New Deal Democrat and quickly became a Republican. Reagan started as a New Deal Democrat, and in his autobiography writes, even at the end of World War II, he called himself a bleeding heart liberal, and eventually moves to become a conservative Republican. Charlton Heston was the first Hollywood figure to march in a civil rights parade demonstration. He was a liberal Democrat who endorsed the New Deal and was, in fact, a liberal Democrat up until 1972, and then he became a conservative. Arnold never was a liberal. But here you have several figures moving from left to right, but I've never seen anybody move from the right to the left in terms of movie stars. And I'd love to know, if anyone can think of it, you can email me at sjross@usc.edu. Or just go on the history website at US University of Southern California, because I can't think of a prominent star on the right who moved to the left.
As we were talking, we've sort of skimmed over a couple of the famous people that you did chapters on in the book. One was Harry Belafonte.
And of all the people I interviewed, absolutely the most charismatic person I've met. With Harry Belafonte, I discovered a story that was not in the history books, that is really only being known now both through what I've written on him, but more what he's written in his own autobiography, where he's finally come out and talked about. Harry Belafonte was one of the Martin Luther King's two closest friends. Harry Belafonte was the single biggest donor to the civil rights movement. And Harry Belafonte essentially walked away. He had a career as both a movie star, a TV star, and most successfully as a singer. And again, what audiences may not know, in 1957, at the kind of peak of his career, singing-wise, he was selling more records than either Elvis or Frank Sinatra. And in 1959, disgusted with what he saw as the lack of politics in Hollywood on television and music, he walked away and went to work for King for the civil rights movement for the next 9 years. And when I asked him how, and the more and more he told me about this, I said, I've read this stuff. How come, you know, people mention you were there and you were participating, but we have no idea what a central role you played. And he laughed and he said, well, that's because if you are a radical fighting the forces of capitalism, imperialism, and racism, you need to build as many alliances as you can. And you need to build a genuine big tent, not a rhetorical one, where everyone on the left is brought together. And you can't afford to have these factional fights on the left that has paralyzed the movement forever. And consequently, he became the only person who could move between the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SNCC, CORE, all the other Urban League, all the other groups, and particularly SNCC and the SCLC began to really fracture as SNCC got more militant in the latter part of the 60s. And Harry Belafonte was the only man they would listen to because they trusted him. And he worked, and he used to say, I didn't want to be in the spotlight. It would have been very easy for a celebrity like me to get a lot of national attention. But the movement would not have been taken seriously to have a singer movie star as its head. It needed to be focused on Dr. King. And that's why I purposefully stayed under the radar. And the only time I came out is when Dr. King, which is what he called him to this day, Dr. King would say, Harry, we need money. And then I would go do a bunch of concerts and take what I needed for my family and give the rest to Dr. King.
Now, wasn't he also affected personally by his commitments?
Yes, it really undermined what people also don't know, unless you've really paid attention, is his mentor was Paul Robeson, the most, as Adolphe Manjou said, the most dangerous black man in America. And when Manjou was testifying, Adolphe Manjou was probably the most conservative actor in Hollywood during the 30s and 40s. And when he testified before HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and they asked him, how would you define communism? He said, well, I can define communist. Anybody who goes to a Harry Belafonte concert and applauds is a communist. Or, excuse me, to a Paul Robeson concert and applause is a communist. Well, Robeson became the mentor for what I would call the Harlem Left, which is in the late 40s. It was Belafonte, it was Ruby Dee, Ozzie Davis, and Sidney Poitier. And when Belafonte got called before, actually he was called before some of the Red Baiters for participating in this, he was supposed to go on the Ed Sullivan Show, and they weren't sure they'd let him on. And he went to talk to Robeson and said, what do I do? And Robeson said, Harry, remember, use your art as a weapon. I was making, you know, six figures until I got blacklisted, and now I'm making $2,500 a year. Basically, he told them to tell them what they wanted to hear. And so it wasn't that Belafonte lied, but he sort of feigned ignorance. I didn't know these groups I was singing at were left. You know, gee, I'm not going to do this again. So he got to sing on Ed Sullivan and continue his career. But it affected his marriage when he and his first wife divorced. She claimed it was about politics, that all he could think about and talk about was politics, that he ignored his family, he ignored his wife, he ignored everything on behalf of his politics. And when he got married to Julie, who is a white woman, he also suffered because for Harry Belafonte, he believed racial progress will happen when we don't talk about the color of who we love. And it got him in trouble with whites. It got him in trouble with blacks. And so he suffered a great deal for his politics.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with historian Stephen Ross about his book, Hollywood Left and Right, which is just out in paperback. Now, if we fast forward one more time, what would you say Warren Beatty's legacy is?
Well, Beatty is really interesting because Beatty did most of the stars I wrote about did a particular kind of activism. Beatty was doing everything. He was active in the political trenches working for candidates. In particular, he was the media advisor and part of the inner circle both for George McGovern's campaign, but then became really a key advisor for the Gary Hart campaign, really talking to him about, in a sense, the Democratic equivalent of George Murphy. How do you use the media to present your ideas in the most effective way? And we're no longer in a day and age where you can talk for an hour and people get to listen. You have to talk in sound bites. So he was trying to train both McGovern and Hart. How do you talk in sound bites? How do you get these crisp, to-the-point sentences? And at one point, I was interviewing Gary Hart, and he told me, I can still remember being in Warren's kitchen, and, you know, I was going through one of my speeches with him, and he kept interrupting me. You're taking too long. You're taking too long. You're taking too long. Get to the point. Get to the point. Get to the point. So Beatty was really instrumental there, except, you know, as people pointed out to me after reading that chapter, they said, yeah, but these guys all lost.
Both of them, yeah.
Well, it wasn't about necessarily winning, because that gets into a whole nother issue about what I call the 50.1% dilemma that's run through American politics, particularly left politics, which is your goal to get elected, to do what you need to do to get elected, to get that 50.1%, and then when you're in office, in other words, you may have to compromise, but you compromise, you get into office, and then you fight for what you believe in. Or the other side says, but if you compromise so much to get that 50.1, you have nothing left to really bring to the office. And Beatty was a believer that, you know, you had to say what you wanted to say. And ideally, you want to get into office, but you got to raise the consciousness of the people. So I don't think he saw himself as a loser, even though those people lost the elections. The other thing Beatty did is he said, well, and in the end, because he was asked to run for Senate, and if people may remember, people were trying to approach him to run as the Reform Party candidate in 2000 in the presidential election. And the Reform Party was the party that got Jesse Ventura elected governor in Minnesota. And he felt ultimately that, no, I can do more politically in film, because in film, I control everything. And if you look at his films, from Bonnie and Clyde to Shampoo to Reds and to a film that I particularly like, Bullworth.
I loved Bullworth.
These are very political movies, particularly Reds and Bullworth. As a Shampoo, these are very stinging political commentaries, and Beatty gets it because you're trying to merge entertainment with politics. You're not trying to make movies that are on the nose. You're trying to make movies that can entertain audiences, and in the course of entertaining them, you give them a strong political message. And so he's had that career as movie star activist, candidate activist, behind-the-scenes advisor. And, you know, now it's sort of his, you know, he's run his course.
You're a historian, so using the past as a basis to look into the future, do you see up-and-coming actors who might be taking on the role of the next?
Yes. The only one I can tell you on the left who has a shot at this moment is George Clooney. Because if you look at, you know, who's on the left today that people would know? Sean Penn, George Clooney, and Alec Baldwin. Well, Sean Penn is too far to the left for most people. You know, once he goes and he's a big Hugo Chavez supporter and he's in the front row, along with Harry Belafonte at Chavez's funeral, that's enough. That's it. You know, you have no chance. Alec Baldwin, liberal Democrat, left liberal Democrat, but, all, you know, the minute they play that tape of him leaving the phone message, forget about his wife. People can understand you getting mad at your wife. You can't insult your child in the way he insulted her, calling her a fat pig. And that would, they would just play that he has no chance. But George Clooney has followed what I call the route that in many ways Charlton Heston pioneered, which is image politics, where you have a cinematic image that is so strong and so positive that people begin to believe that the image and the man are one and the same. So if you look across time, one could say on the right, someone like John Wayne had that, Jimmy Stewart had that, on the left, Gregory Peck had that, Charlton Heston had that, Moses. First he used it on the left, because it wasn't just being the first guy to participate in a civil rights demonstration. He led the Hollywood contingent on the March on Washington. And he used the Moses image very much to promote left causes. And then after 1972, when he broke with the Democrats, he used it on behalf of gun control and Republican candidates. And I believe that today George Clooney has the image as a positive, straight shooter, somebody people would believe. You know, Eastwood had that as a conservative, but, you know, he harmed himself at the last convention. The talking to the chair just,
yeah.
I think people thought the guy's lost it now. Yeah. He's lost. And that's the problem of an actor who believes he can go off script. He's not as bright as he thinks he is. He's not a dumb guy by any means, but you can't go off script at a national convention like that and suddenly bomb and expect to have the influence anymore. But it would be Clooney on the left. And I don't think there's anybody right now on the right who I would say, it has that gravitas that could attract maybe somebody from the what I would call the independent side or the uncommitted side.
And finally, given the enduring legacy of Ronald Reagan, which really has shaped American politics for decades,
right?
Do you see a new shape developing as a result of Somebody Hollywood, or do you think it's going to be a continuation?
No. First of all, as people who look at this carefully would say, it's no longer Reagan. Because Reagan would still be too liberal for many, certainly for the Tea Party, he would be too liberal. I think we're seeing now a major shift, and I'm not sure which Republican is going to come out of Hollywood, but it's going to have to be somebody who compromises more. All you have to do is look what's going on in the Senate and in the House, and it's Republicans are realizing the demographics of this country have changed. Old conservative white men are no longer to be able to rule in the same blatant way. They will still rule this country, but they can't be as blatant anymore. And right now, the whole idea of immigration reform passing, of trying to create a compromise on gun control, these are all Republicans see that they have to move back towards the middle a little bit. They have to move from the extreme right to the far right. You know, they're not moving into a liberal position. It's not going to be liberal Republicans anymore. But it will be not Tea Party ruling. So if there's going to be a candidate who comes out, it's going to have to be somebody who can play to what became known as the Reagan Democrats. That is, blue-collar Democrats who got so fed up with the seeming liberal politics of the party that they sort of moved into the Republican camp or they became independents. And right now, certainly amongst young voters, independents, I believe, are the fastest growing sector. So you're going to have to get a Republican who can speak to that group, who can be a gentle. It's what Schwarzenegger tried to do and for a while was actually successful until he couldn't rule. And that's something Warren Beatty pointed out when he was asked and pressured, won't you run against Schwarzenegger in 2000? And what Beatty said is, you know, I know how to run for office. That's not the problem. I don't know how to govern in office. And those are two different things. And Arnold knew how to run for office. He didn't know how to govern in office. You can't insult legislators.
And then work with them.
I mean, it's one thing to do it in a campaign and in general, but when you get kind of calling them girly men and getting to that level and talking about how they're inefficient, how you're going to get rid of all of them, and then they're all there, how do you expect to work with them? And then, again, attacking them in that way, once you're the governor, you can't do it. I mean, and that's what you saw. It is, he kept saying running a campaign is like running a movie opening. And he's right. You want to create a lot of pizzazz. But once the movie opens, the movie has to carry itself. And Schwarzenegger, the governor, the movie, was not strong enough. The previews look good. But the actual movie didn't work at all and fell flat. And he went from being, if we remember, there was time people were saying, let's have a constitutional amendment to allow immigrants to run for presidency. That wouldn't float now.
Well, Stephen J. Ross, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, the book is called Hollywood Left and Right.